So how is it that when the reminders sort of fade, it's kind of like the water goes out of the bathtub? It's like, shit, I've landed in a regular life. This sucks.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's right. I mean, that's exactly how it rolls. You know, I mean, you see people go through frantic periods of seeking or practice or, you know, various other indulgences. But when this slips away from you, it slips away from you. There's nothing you can do. This is just, you know, you just kick back. You just roll with it. I mean, I've seen people that, you know, they're enlightened or they've had this insight or that insight, and then something happens and they just get thrown for a total loop, you know, and then land on their ass and you're like, okay. You know, you wonder if, you wonder what the utility is sometimes.
Yeah, that's true. Well, because we don't have a choice.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on how strange you feel. It depends on how affectionate or intimate one wants to become with how strange this is. Right. So the moment that, we occupy experience as a person that, you know, got up from bed this morning and put some clothes on, then the whole rush of continuity and moving through life as a creature is, you know, instantaneously on tap. And so we schedule and we move about from that perspective. And, you know, to get accustomed to this life being far stranger than the cloak of my humanness, that takes, I don't know, it takes a certain amount of magic, or it takes a certain amount of time, or it takes a certain amount of, you know, acquaintance and chipping away. And even people that have meditated for years or done yoga for years, that shit doesn't put any dent, doesn't put a dent in the remarkable capacity for consciousness to presume creaturehood. Not a dent. I was visiting a friend out in Olima yesterday. His name is Ray, and two old friends of his were there. And I mean, I just started messing with their heads right away. I mean, it's just me, you know. I don't even think about it. I just do it. He introduced one of them as a guy that's been around the block for years, you know, Zen and da-da-da-da-da, and studied with Philip Kaplow, who was, forget the Zen Center of Rochester or something. Philip Kaplow was a renowned, you know, Zen teacher, practitioner, and author. He wrote The Three Pillars of Zen, and a lot of people stand by that as, you know, one of the formidable books. So I just walk in with my groceries, and Ray says, "Hey, meet Mickey. You know, he was with Philip Kaplow for 7 years or something." And I just walked up to him and said, "I'm sorry to hear that." It was the first thing out of my mouth. I was like, "Oh, I'm really sorry to hear that." And of course, you know, if the guy had any fucking sense, he'd say, "Yeah, I know what you mean. You know, I'm sorry to hear that anything happened." But no, he started defending it. I mean, this guy's near 70 years old. He's meditated the fuck out of anybody. You know, he's done this, that. He's full of devotion and, you know, platitudes. And I just say one offhand comment, and immediately, right, his, you know, ego is in full bloom defending himself and his relationship with Philip Kaplow. And then he's trying to tell me some story about the first meditation retreat he went on, as if he had a remarkable spiritual experience with Philip Kaplow. And I just said, "I hope you don't mind. I don't want to hear it."
Oh my God.
I just write to his face. I said, "You know, I don't really need to hear it." That was it. It got worse, you know. Then you could tell he was already, you know, retributional, right? It was that simple. Here's a guy that's done it all. A model spiritual aspirant, you know, mercenary. A model spiritual mercenary. And all I had to do was say two things. First of all, I'm sorry to hear that you studied with Philip Kaplow, and I don't want to hear about your spiritual experience. And he was already, you know, twisted, turned, and retributional.
You destroyed him.
What did it take? I mean, we're all that vulnerable, you see? So the creeping up of creaturehood and the presumption that I'm the product of experiences that happened prior to now comes in with such a fury and such a force, and that no matter how much spiritual work someone has done, that you know, that identification, that mark of identification or mark of Zorro on our consciousness happens so quickly without invitation, with nothing at all. That's what we're up against. And if you don't see that that's what you're up against, then it's easy to be insulted. You know? And then the guy started talking to me about the Divine Mother and, you know, the Vedanta Society and Ramakrishna and all this other stuff. And I just looked at him and said, you know, that's just a bunch of platitudes. That doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah.
No, but he gets away with that with, I guess, the young people that, you know, study with him or think that there's a reason to do Zen. And then his friend Terence, who was a cool guy, an Irish guy, you know, was used to study Zen, but then he discovered Ramana Maharshi, you know, so now what? So now he's, you know, who am I? A who am I guy? And I said to him, you know, Ramana has been dead for, he's been dead for 60 years now. Why are you even inspired by Ramana Maharshi? You know, and you pull the rug on somebody like that because they've built up their whole spiritual persona and their pursuit of enlightenment through the lens, you know, of Ramana Maharshi. And you're like, you got to be fucking kidding me. But that's the, you know, and here we are, you know, that's what you see. It is still very, very slippery and very strange to not get tied up in, you know, the ceremonial hallucination of experiencing itself. And everyone thinks, oh, well, no, experiencing, well, that's the shit. You know, my experience as a person, as an aspirant, as a spiritual, whatever, that's what's real. And you go like, no, you don't understand. It's not real. If reality can do one thing, the only thing it does is consent. That means whatever you imagine, it consents. Right? Reality never says, oh, time out. That's incorrect. Does it? If you imagine a thing, if you occupy experience as a person, if you have memories and reflections and loyalties and gurus and spiritual experiences, reality will say, hey, that's fantastic. It will never say to you, you dumb fuck, that's not what this is.
That's what you're here for, Jeff.
Well, every once in a while, someone has to say, you know, give me a time out on this.
Yeah.
Because reality just consents. It can only do one thing, which is to say, yes, of course. So someone goes in search of reality, you know, like the guru says something or the mendicant or the yogi or the, you know, the Tibetan nun. Everyone's got something to say, right? The shit rolls off everyone's tongue. And reality just says, oh, yeah, it's cool. Yes. But it's not true. It's not true. Reality does not give a shit if, you know, if we so-called remain asleep or if we question its veracity. So it's truly unusual. Maybe that's why it's, you know, rare, if we could use that word, for a human to get out from under the myth factory and the consent of reality. Because you can't really find anything. And we just refuse to acknowledge that, I would say, more or less simple, if not secular, observation. We want to find something. I want a container for my suffering, and I want a container for the reduction of my suffering. I want a container for my confusion and my rage and my sorrow. And then I want to be the experiencer of someone that has so-called transcended my rage and my loneliness, my regret and my sorrow. But you see, any experiencing that's occurring is the nature of, right? It's a fog machine. So what does freedom look like? Does freedom look like emotional resolution, psychiatric resolution, spiritual resolution, accomplishment, the taking and keeping of vows, How can it? Everything is just a fog machine. And no matter what you think or feel about a thing, it's just going to say yes. It's going to agree with you. Is there, right, an independent, so-called individuated reality? No. Guess what? Hey, psst, there's not. So the looking, whether the looking is for, you know, inspired by scientific interests or spiritual interests or occultist interests, the looking is simply going to reveal more and more and more and more and more and more, more metaphor, you know, more so-called the appearance of causality and consequence. But guess what? There is no causality and there is no consequence because your present experience is not made of anything. It can't contain anything. It can't resolve to anything. And so if that's a curious suggestion of reality, I mean, good luck.
Well, it leaves you so completely with nothing to do that it just throws people.
Yeah.
I mean, the shift in perspective that has to happen, I mean, it's only something you can absorb incrementally until finally it almost reaches a tipping point.
Sure.
Where you feel it.
Okay. Yes. I mean, that's true. Sure. You know, I mean, the dreaming is so good at dreaming that we can look at our present experience, equate it with what we think is prior experience, and then come up with, you know, the lovely tautology you just suggested, which is some kind of incremental approach, right? And the incremental approach only makes sense if something happened before now and something snuck up on you, so-called over time, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not saying it's not true. I'm not saying it is true. It's just you see how sweetly this just consents to whatever you imagine.
True.
Yeah. It just consents. It just does. It doesn't say, oh, he's right, she's not right, you know?
Oh, that's logical.
Yeah, if Muhammad wants to run the Ramadan story, you know, and the Baha'u'llah wants to run the Baha'i story, and the Native Americans want to run the Great Turtle story, you know, and Jesus wants to go for the Trinity, and Ramana wants to say, who am I? And Peter Brown says, well, you'd be lucky if you start noticing. What can you say about it? Well, thank you, Master. It's all true.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because noticing doesn't result in anything. Traveling lighter doesn't result in anything. It's not like we ever occupy our present experience with a newfound spiritual confidence. But once we're under the rubric of identification and individuation, we think that we're having an experience, that what this is an experience, that it's either a pleasant or unpleasant or insufficient or sufficient or more than sufficient or underutilized experience, and we're hot on the trail of somehow making this experiencing better for an experiencer. And then reality says, knock yourself out. Go ahead. Paint a mural. Do Zazen. Worship Ramana Maharshi. Go see Peter Brown. And none of it resolves or turns into anything that you can go, made it. I made it. I got this now. I've made reality my bitch. Reality is just like rock and roll. You see, so it does is just say yes and yes and yes and yes. Cause it's just total permission. It's total permission, total yes. Nothing can interfere nor does it wish to interfere with the dreaming. And we refer to the dreaming as I'm having an experience. And it might be cogently, if not maddeningly true, that that's not the case. You're not having an experience. No condition has been conveyed upon you. You're a fog machine. And so one perhaps then stops seeking to resolve one's existential confusion or existential irritability by coming to a spiritual conclusion. And that's strange. Someone that has sat on the Zen cushion for a long time, that believes that Ramakrishna is relevant, that studied with Philip Kaplow, he thinks something is actually happening here, that he can count on all of the spiritual experiences that he's had to make himself and his life and his sadhana relevant. And I just said to him, no, you're absolutely irrelevant. Not at the expense of my being relevant, but hey, guess what? Psst, nothing is relevant. Nothing is real. Nothing is resolvable. Nothing is true. Except everything is real and everything is true and everything is resolvable. You see, there's no quarrel. There's just no quarrel. But the moment you occupy what you call your life from the vantage point of, you know, putting together shit that's happened, you're just fucking dreaming. And then if someone makes the slightest remark about your guru or about your loyalty, boy, your temperature goes right up. And then you want to defend the imagination of the life that you thought that you'd lived. Because who and what would you be without it? If like Ramakrishna is not relevant, then maybe you're not so relevant. And you can't stand, or one can't stand, to be irrelevant. So Ramana fucking Maharshi had better be relevant. Krishnamurti had better be relevant. Gurdjieff had better be, someone had better be relevant, because if they're not relevant, well, what's in it for me? And very few dare to tread where, you know, one's need or insistence or compulsion even for relevancy is just flown out the window. You mean even Byron Katie, you know, as brilliant as she is, becomes completely irrelevant. When the seeker... Go ahead.
The whole argument for irrelevancy?
Yeah.
Is very tempting to hang your hat on. It's not relevant, so just fuck it all.
Well, it really depends. You know, irrelevancy is not a... It's not personal, you see. It has nothing to do with who or what you think you are. So the irrelevancy I'm referring to is not I'm irrelevant and therefore I'm going to hang up my hat and say fuck it. See, it has nothing to do with you, right? I mean, the irrelevancy is not about a person that now has no, let's say, no value, right? No inspiration. No, it's I'm looking at something, can I say, to be glib, deeper than that. Experience itself has no relevancy. So then what kind of reaction can you possibly have? Right? If you have a reaction as, well, things aren't relevant and I'm not relevant, so therefore I might end up behaving a certain way, I would say that's not quite an accurate portrayal. In order for you or something or experience to be relevant, for us to need it to be relevant, urgently insist that it's relevant, there has to be the... you know, winning or losing model of my subjectivity, right? My experience as a person, as a body, right? And if you're not a person, if you're not a body, and someone says, you know, everything is, you could say, equivalently irrelevant, well, then you have no reaction to it. Does that make sense? The irrelevancy is not behavioral. It's ontological. Right? As in consciousness itself, existence itself.
Well, we don't know what existence is. If everything is dreaming, that's totally, that includes irrelevance then.
Yeah, absolutely it does. Of course, it has to. Yeah. Yeah. Relevance and irrelevance in the way that I'm referring to it has nothing to do with me, the person, right? Me, the body, the I, me, my that maybe was born. It has nothing to do with that.
Well, if you're dreaming all this anyway, if you come to me and insult me, my immediate reaction is, well, this is just still dreaming, you know?
Yeah, who knows, right? I mean, who knows what one's reaction would be? It kind of depends on how you're, you know, let's say feeling in the moment, right?
Yeah, feeling in the moment, absolutely. Other times it could hurt horribly.
Yeah, sure. You know, if you're off your game and you're busy with yourself and your inventory and your stuff and the things that are bothering you and someone comes along and insults you, you know, you might break their nose even. You know, but if you're, let's say, staggering around in the beauty of absolute irrelevancy and someone insults you, you're like, coffee? Can I get you some coffee? Right? Pleased to meet you. Isn't it curious? You know, we might go to the teacher like many go to Byron Katie, you know, as kind of a maternal figure for something to become, something to do, a way to feel, a way to organize reality, a way to mitigate or ameliorate or heal our suffering. And so she gives us herself, which is very generous. And then she gives us the work, which you could say is also very generous. But you can see what happens is that we fetishize ourselves, we fetishize her, and then we fetishize the work. And that's how we create the imagination of relevancy when there actually is none. And she's happy to take your money while she is selling you the imagination of relevancy. Even the relevancy of the work or what it might portray. But if you go underneath that and you're like, wow, this fucker really dreams up a storm. And all it can do is say yes. It just consents to whatever I imagine or it imagines. Now, of course, you know, we have to go through a certain kind of maturing process because I'm still suffering from the imagination of my life. From the vagaries and vicissitudes of the inventory of my life, then I am too relevant, right? I am too relevant. My body's been insulted. My identity's been insulted. Perhaps my sexuality has been insulted. My hairdo has been insulted. My intelligence has been insulted, right? I mean, we've been insulted a million ways, and we've also been perpetrators of insult, sometimes deliberately and sometimes quite by mistake. But you see, as long as we're identified with my life up to this point, having been anything at all, then I am a sitting duck for insult because I'm resting on the hallucination of personal or call it, ontological relevance. And it's not, we don't even have to, let's say, emphasize, you know, the notion of relevance or irrelevance. It's interchangeable. We're just looking at, does present experience actually convey that you have lived a life? Or is the felt sense of having lived a life apparitionally appearing as some kind of bizarre handshake, you could say, between memory and consciousness? And memory and consciousness are not two. Then we bargain for continuity. I wasn't feeling so good today, but I'm hoping to feel better tomorrow. Or my life up to this point has been racked with disappointment and the cyclic nature of all of my addictive and compensatory behaviors. But I'm, you know, now I'm on a new Zen course, or I'm taking a new medication, or I'm seeing a new therapist, or I'm becoming certified in the work so that I can hopefully get off the hamster wheel of my despicable self. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, right? As long as we're on the hamster wheel of the imagination of my despicable self, we would be wise to do something to try to mitigate or ameliorate it. I'm just looking at, is it possible, might it be possible to get off the hamster wheel of the imagination of my despicable self entirely? And that's different, I would argue, than medicating or ameliorating or even healing the imagination of my life.
You could say that irrelevancy is the healing force.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that's right. Irrelevancy is a revelation. It's a revelation of the release of all ideation, of all identification, of temporality. Yes, and so that is a healing force. But not in the, well, you could say it's a healing force in the way we sometimes look at healing, or in ways that are kind of transcendent of the way that we typically refer to healing. Right? I mean, the annihilation of self, the annihilation of the hallucination that I have lived a life up to this point, some might run away from that or be very angry to even hear it. Some others might say, wow, that sounds like fucking healing to me. Count me in. And of course, reality is just going to say, but of course. Right? It's just going to say yes, because it doesn't have a dog in the fight. It doesn't
Whatever
care.
You want.
That's right. It doesn't care what side of the equation you come out on, because reality knows full well that it's nothing at all. And so it doesn't mind if you think that it's something, because it's like, you know, you're, in that case, you're welcome. You have, you know, let's say the argument of absolute free will, right? Not to get into the, you know, the presence or absence of the free will equation, though we can. It's just reality. All it can do is say, okay, it consents.
Well, free will is, again, meaningless in this context.
Yes. Yes, it is. That's right. Free will is meaningless. Right. And so is the so-called opposite of free will, which suggests, you know, what, predestiny?
The opposite of free will would be, well, no, because anything can happen.
Okay. So then there's neither predestiny.
Or anything can appear to happen.
Yes, yes, there's neither predestiny or free will.
Yeah, they're both irrelevant.
They're both absolutely irrelevant. And that's kind of a curious perspective, considering how frequently, you know, free will and premeditation or predestiny has been argued.
Yeah, it just changes the foundation.
It changes the whole game.
Yeah, utterly.
Yeah, and I would, you know, as from a biased point of view, look at that, or the potential of that understanding, as being, as you pointed out, you know, healing of a different order of magnitude.
Well, I get convinced at times, of course, reality will agree with me, that what we perceive at the body of, as the body, is just kind of a manifestation of all the pain and the lies that we believe.
That's one way to look at it. And again, you're absolutely right. Reality would say, you know, bravo. Yeah, it would say, of course.
And then when you render it, you know, as non-existent, well, yeah, a lot of shit goes away.
A lot of shit has to go away once you, and I don't even mean once. I mean, that starts to look like something that occurs in time or an event. But here's whatever reality is right about now. We can't find reality prior to now. We can't find reality, you know, other than now. And so here it is. Here is the entirety, right? The unabashed, unobscured, non-withholding, perfect yes in all caps of what we might refer to as reality. And it's like, okay, right? It's not carving itself up. It's not insisting on continuity.
It's just hanging out.
Just hanging the fuck out. Really. Yeah. Reality loiters. And, you know, I mean, Fukushima's and nuclear meltdowns and, you know, war and police brutality and, you know, corporate fascistic takeover of human consciousness is also reality's like, yeah, cool. Sounds great. Hey, look what this bacteria is capable of doing. But you see, the urgency for relevancy, the urgency for a conclusion, the urgency for an explanation, the urgency for where we're going with all this, right, is absolutely imagined. We want to believe that Ramakrishna was somehow useful, you know, to the spiritual unfolding of God knows how many so-called people. We want to believe that the Divine Mother is looking out for our best interests, you know. We want to anthropomorphize the peculiar gender-neutral nature of reality and, you know, pay obeisance to something or someone, right? Worship something or someone. Whether it's the divine feminine or the divine masculine or some combination of those two, right? The divine zygote. And that's, and, you know, that was kind of the, what would you say? The friendly wedge I was suggesting to raise dear, you know, Buddhistic friends. Like I said, I can't, you know, it's like, I can't believe you guys have been around the block and still believe with all of this feigned sincerity in the ideas that are, you know, have popped into your own heads. I mean, don't you have a sense of suspicion that you're just a couple of bumbling idiots like everybody? Or do you really need to be someone that believes in Ramana Maharshi or, you know, has studied martial arts or had a spiritual experience with Philip Kaplow? Who gives a fuck? And if you still give a fuck, then as far as I'm concerned, you're not really paying attention. you're still living according to the sorrow field of the hope for personal relevancy. It's a sorrow field.
Any personal relevancy, what difference does it make if you're hanging out with a group of people that are all sure they're people and that they're right, or you're hanging out with, you know, people that are really wondering if they're anybody at all? Does it
it's up to you. It's totally up to you, right? And the way that you feel about it, when you feel that way about it. And I'm not saying you have to feel about it the same way. I mean, you can hang out with one group and have an ecstatic time. You can hang out with another group and not have an ecstatic time. So if there's any meaning being, you know, perpetrated, it's just appearing spontaneously, so-called, in your experience. And all, what's reality going to say about it? Hey, fantastic. Great opinion you've got there. Right? There is no value, but there is no not value. Because you see, any measure or mark of what we might be referring to as relevancy or irrelevancy is not thick enough to accuse ourselves or anybody else of it. Right? So there's no accusation. So now if there's no accusation, then relevancy or irrelevancy is no longer a vehicle for measurement or preference. I mean, you hang out where you hang out, you know. if they've got a pig on the spit, you know, wait till dinner time. Right. If they don't have a pig on the spit and people are getting a little too inebriated and sloppy, then leave earlier.
Oh, I love pig on the spit.
Well, then stay.
I will.
Yeah. You know what I mean? But isn't it true for everything that seems to occur in your momentary experience? You know, sometimes washing the dishes could be ecstatic. Sometimes it's like, why me? Right? Going to work could be a bliss fest of, you know, imagery passing by. Or it could be hell if you just had a fight with someone or you're preoccupied about having to, you know, give a presentation.
And there's that ongoing negotiation with those states.
Absolutely. We are by nature, pretty much nonstop preoccupied with what we think is our experience.
And the negotiation doesn't really ever go anywhere.
Have you noticed?
We constantly negotiate. Rolling.
Yeah, I mean, here you are right now. I mean, this is the pinnacle of your life. It is. This is it. Oh shit. This happens to be the pinnacle of your life right now. So you tell me, can you even remember with any, you know, sincerity or accuracy, any of the negotiation that you've done prior to this moment? Not really. You can't. And yet we still remain, you know, somewhat, let's say call it habitually embroiled in the fantasy of negotiation. And clearly it amounts to nothing. I mean, that's what I'm playing with as the view of, you know, irrelevancy. Not your personal irrelevancy, because it's easy for us to get defended around that. I'm looking at the, let's call it the neutrality, right? The evocative and expressive neutrality of experiencing itself, of consciousness itself, because it simply does not resolve. Well, now that, you know, if there's a spiritual adventure to be had, or even a secular adventure to be had, you know, that adventure turns out to be this. If there is a fullness, if there is something that might look or feel like, you know, liberation, enlightenment, call it what you will, well, it had better be exactly what this is. Otherwise, it's an idea. Otherwise, it's a an idolatry of the future. Right?
Yep.
That's how we get fucked up, you see. We're hoping that by participating in some kind of practice or path or repetition or skill set, that we can turn enlightenment into an idolatry of the future and hope someday to arrive.
It's because the present frequently seems to just suck.
Good t-shirt. Have you noticed the present frequently seems to just suck?
Who the hell doesn't want to say, well, I'm going to negotiate and
yes.
do this and that and make
yes. sure
the future looks a little better?
Absolutely. And what does reality say? Good idea.
You're right. That's a good idea.
Yeah, reality doesn't say, oh, you might want to think twice about that. It just says, hey, that's great. You know? Oh, that's because it can't really lift a finger. It doesn't really have a quarrel. It's like, okay. Look, it knows it's dreaming. It's just imagining random shit. You know, you could say it all, at all levels and frequencies of intelligence, sentient and non-sentient, right? Cosmic and super cosmic. And it's like, hey, this rocks. it's never not itself, so it doesn't seem to mind. So if we want to dream that enlightenment is an idolatry of the future, it's like, knock yourself out, you know, get going, don't dawdle. But it also doesn't have a quarrel if you just sit or stand or be wherever the fuck you are and like, oh, this doesn't mean anything, right? It's like, oh, I'm not investing enough interest in experiencing itself for it to suck or for me to have to do or want to do something about it. And I don't want to antagonize anybody by coming up with a whole bunch of, idle and superficial, statements about the Divine Mother. You know what I mean? It's like, we tend to go evangelical at making it look like we're surrendered, you know? I'm like, I don't think so. And that's what I told the guy. He started telling me about the Ramakrishna and the this and the that. And I said, really? All you're doing is throwing evangelical platitudes in my face. You know? And that threw him off again, of course, because he thinks most times he can get away with that crap. But not with me. Mickey, I said, I'm not really interested in evangelical platitudes. You know, but whatever relationship you have with the Divine Mother's fine with me.
Well, it sounds like people who are on isn't Bhakti Yogi the devotional path?
Yeah, Bhakti Yoga, yes.
They seem to have a hard time getting off of it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, some, you know, all yogas can be, what would you call them, cul-de-sacs of self, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all yogas also have, you could say, the chutzpah, to liberate. And reality sure isn't holding its, his, her breath. Because it just dreams. And it's like, hey, whatever you're dreaming right now, that's good for me. You know, I mean, you want to pick up a Saturday night special and go down to the local drugstore, you know, or the alcohol store and put a gun in someone's face and walk out with $35 in cash and then end up, you know, on the video? Go ahead. You know, you want to kill 9 million Cambodians or 10 million Jews or 15 million gypsies or 20 million Russians? Hey, far out.
Why so negative? Let's give some good examples. All sorts of shit happens here.
Fantastic shit happens. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I'm happy with everything, I guess.
I'd be happy. Marin County sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, hell, we've got, you know, we've got Byron Katie and Adyashanti and Peter Brown and
Adam Chaxfield,
Paul Hederman and Adam Chaxfield and Bentinho Massaro. And we've got, you know, we've got Bat Gap and Conscious TV. And we've got we are rolling, fucking rolling in enlightenment.
There's loads of fun to be had.
And have it. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I mean, we don't shy away from fun. I don't go up to, Our Lady of, Częstochowa and, you know, flagellate myself, in public and, you know, pour salt in my festering, you know, whip wounds.
Well, Nan and I were going to do that this weekend.
Yeah, I know. You go up there for a Coca-Cola and a nice warm kielbasa.
Sure, that does sound like fun.
It is fun.
Well, let's go.
Yeah, really. The impulse, right? The impulse of whatever consciousness may or may not be is, well, I mean, it attention seeks, right? Justification, explanation, consequence. It's like the more knowledge we have, we think that we can steer through the jungle with, let's say, greater success or greater accuracy. we can steer through the jungle of the unpredictable nature of life experience with, you know, more aplomb, with less suffering, if only we could figure out what this was.
Doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work.
It's funny how many people you'll find as like poster children for, oh yeah, I got this.
Yes.
This work.
Yep.
And it's just, you can kind of see right through it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, those teachers that like to sell, you know, the cake and eat it too approach, or the, you know, the secret, or positive reinforcement, or the law of attraction, or, you know, living both a divinely successful, enlightened life, right? And everyone's, you know, everyone jumps in. I doubt all that many of those students actually end up living an enviable, enlightened, empowered life. But once the teachers have some kind of a formula and they start attracting, you know, enough poor souls to part with their money, then that's a nice way to make a living.
Yeah.
I mean, in our, you know, in the spiritual and self-help world, right, charisma gets monetized. Nothing wrong with that.
Well, it's celebrity consciousness in that world as just like,
yep,
in the other world.
That's right. It's celebrity consciousness. That's right. And it works within the, you know, the context of the fantasy of becoming, the fantasy of experiencing, of relevance, the relevance of my life. And my right, my desire to be joyful.
But that seems completely legitimate to me.
Yes, yes, yes. Reality says yes. You know, language by its nature tends to draw a line in the sand, right? By making something true at the expense of its opposite.
Yes, right? It does that.
Right? So language and knowledge and comparison makes it look like, you know, there's a winning and a losing hand. Whereas reality, if there were such a thing, just says, yeah, no, everyone's a winner. Everyone gets bingo. You know, even if you, Peter spoke this past Sunday at the open circle thing, and, you know, he's doing what he loves to do and kind of, what would you say, articulating, curious insights into the so-called nature of experience or the nature of reality, right? Whether it was space or time or mind or meaning, right? Or the duration, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you're following the pedantic logic of what he's putting forth, you're like, wow, that's some curious shit. I never thought of it that way. Right.
Right.
And for some people, it's thrilling to hear. For others, it's really infuriating to hear. You know, one gal in the audience gave him a lot of shit. You know, he was, because that stuff can be very triggering, even if it's spoken in a kind of a dry, philosophical, you know, format.
Well, no question, yeah.
Yeah. That's right. And, you know, I mean, it has its charms.
What, speaking like Peter does?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I couldn't stand to listen to any of it. I mean, I enjoyed being there, but I was in the back rolling around on a carpet. You know.
He says the words are not, you know, their words are just kind of fluff. He'll say that straight up.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting to present yourself, you know, let's say to an audience of people that you have not met before and try to figure out how to reach out to them. Fred, get back in the house.
Oh, sorry. I thought I was muted.
God damn it, Fred. Get back in the house.
Hi, Francine.
I'm going to go and mute myself now so I can yell.
Yeah, I mean, how do you present yourself to, let's say, an audience that has come to a so-called spiritual talk given by, you know, someone whose name is, you know, Fred? Right? What do you say? Hey, everyone, what's going on? You know? I'm fucked up on reality. How about you? You don't get, you know, you, by and large, don't get an audience that's like ready to completely abandon the myth of experience, do you? People don't show up in large numbers going, rock on, motherfucker. Let's abandon the myth of experience.
Well, they don't even know what you're talking about.
That tends to be true. Yeah. Maybe that's why I like it. It's just as irrelevant as its own message. It's like when we're confronted with the built-in urgency that we have for meaning, for relevancy, for continuity, right? For future, for explanation, for mitigation, for ecstasy. We're like, oh my God, I never realized that I am just a total jumble, right? Of compulsion. I am a nonstop total jumble of compulsion. And experiencing is weirder than fucking weird, but I turn it into, a pedestrian event. And then because I get sick and tired of having turned experiencing into a pedestrian event, well, now I want it to be special. So I'm sure glad that Ramana Maharshi was around to help me out. For my money, not that I take any or have any, for my money, it's like, well, whoa, let's just step back. Let's walk it back and say, before we launch into a solution for the frustration of an imaginary problem like my experience, let's see if we can't parse this out a little differently. I mean, I realize it's never going to be a popular approach. Any meaning that shows up in your present experience, you could see only has meaning by virtue of contrast, only has meaning by virtue of some kind of confidence or presumption or comparison, right? Without confidence or comparison, without preference, without memory, without the past, without context, you're going to have a really hard time assigning meaning to your present experience. I could argue for fun that liberation amounts to the revelation that you do not need to assign meaning to your present experience. You don't need to inhabit present experience with any confidence at all. None. I mean, really, really, really none. No confidence at all. That means you're not perturbed by it. You're not insisting on an explanation, a consequence, relevancy, future, right? You can be, one can be completely unfettered, even under the influence of experiencing, which is a different angle, I would suggest, than hoping that experiencing goes my way. Right?
More than hoping, it's like working it, or thinking I'm the one working it.
Yes, that's right.
Or thinking I've worked it, so I got this bitch.
Yes. Yes.
Believing. Yeah. Because you believe that, and then pretty soon you're believing, oh, this sucks, and I must have not done it right.
Well, you can see that from your own experience that any consequence can follow. Right? Any hallucination can follow from the original investment that experience is occurring to me. Right? Because one has an opinion about the texture and nature of experience from the vantage point of our feigned humanity, of the imagination of corporeal nature. Then we have opinions. Oh, well, that was good for me. It wasn't good for me. That, you know, that looks good. You know, that color looks good on me. That color doesn't. Oh, that experience suits me. That experience doesn't. This investment counselor sucks. This investment counselor is, you know, things are going my way. Right? What am I going to do about, you know, this cold that I've had for 3 months? Or the diagnosis that I just had. I mean, we're completely overwhelmed. I'm not saying in a good or bad way, overwhelmed or immersed in the pageantry of experience nonstop. Experience as the body, experience as the person, experience as the mind, right? The convincing nature of continuity, relevancy.
Well, until it occurs to you that you don't have to be, I mean, that's a huge leap.
Yes, yes, it could be huge. From the vantage point of being inhabited, it's a huge leap. From the vantage point of having no inhabitation whatsoever, it's like, you know, business as usual.
Well, yeah, then it's not a leap.
That's right. Then it's not a leap. And if it's a huge leap, the only reason it's a huge leap is because we believe something sufficiently to think that the contrast or the opposite of that is huge, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And so that's what we're looking at. We're just looking at the texture, the genesis, the engine, the mechanics of what we call belief and superstition and relevancy based on the irrefutable nature of experiencing itself. See, we want to be free from the shit that we don't like while remaining as the person. We don't know what it would start to look or feel like if the freedom were from consciousness itself, from the imposition of meaning itself. That's why it's easy to insult people that have some kind of spiritual idea. Everyone wants to be fucking holy.
assault pretty much anyone.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
The trick was to not a trick, but it's not possible for me to be insulted if I don't think I'm a me. It's not possible. I'm not holding on to anything. Or if you insult me, I can like kind of look and say, yeah, I can find it.
Yes.
There's no stick. It just doesn't really stick.
Yeah. Nothing sticks. Nothing sticks. That's the strange, you know, observation. Experiencing isn't going anywhere. But nothing sticks. You're not imposing any meaning upon yourself or upon experiencing or qualifying experiencing as either favorable or unfavorable to the likes of you. Does that sound like freedom? Something we could, you know, sell or suggest as freedom?
Sounds good to me.
I like it. And it truly is a very different texture than trying to resolve or suggest or inhabit a certain quality of experience that is ultimately satisfactory. Right? The seeker is entrapped by hoping to have a quality of experience that is spiritually or otherwise satisfactory. But the sage, the jnani, is like, experience? Who gives a fuck about experience?
And don't you think we all suspect it's unresolvable?
Yes, I think that we do suspect that it's unresolvable because the evidence of it is so absurdly in our face.
Yeah.
But it's at odds with the conditioning of the human conformist consensus reality.
Hence everyone's existential angst.
That's right. Everyone, you could say, has this kind of innate existential angst because the observation of actual experience, which is not that difficult to see, is at odds with the consensus reality that insists upon relevance. That's why we're going to end up killing ourselves, because of that existential split. Because the evildoers, right, the 1/10 of the 1%, because they can't handle the existential angst, right, they come up with remarkable control dramas.
It's not just that group, it's everybody.
Yeah, no, I like to blame somebody, you know, for Mercury and Tuna.
They don't have a corner on the shitty market.
No one really has a corner on the shitty market.
They're just easy targets.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, I mean, whatever anyone or anything is doing is at the so-called behest of consciousness itself, which is not really paying all that much attention.
But that sounds different than the happy puppy. That you just can't, like, sort of get off you and stop it from licking your face.
They all work. I mean, you know, it depends on the sentiment of the day, right? The mood of the day. It could be the happy puppy, and it could be, you know, the evil march of the end of the species. The happy yep. puppy. Yeah. Yeah.
And it doesn't matter. It's like they're equal.
Yes, right. They're equal and unequal. It's kind of, you know, up to you because you have free will to imagine it as you wish to from moment to moment. What we have at our disposal is, you know, the nonstop, highly pixelated tragicomedy of distraction, effusion, profusion. This is simply a field of profusion, brilliant in all and every respect. Sounds like the birds are enjoying the talk.
Yeah.
Man, that's really beautiful.
I love the porch here. And it's always better when Jeff's talking.
Crazy people.
We miss you, Jeff. All right, I miss you.
Thank you.
There's a kind of a sense of, I don't want to say out of control, but now, the closer you get to this and the whole non-causality thing, it's like, it does really kind of feel a little out of control. It's like, what the fuck? Whether it's emotions moving through or situations.
It's pretty, yeah. Well, control itself, you know, is just a fragment. The notion or the expectation of control is total hallucination. Because we've never exercised control. We've never been under control. Nothing has ever obeyed us, including ourselves. And so control means what exactly? Things should be the way I want them to be?
Yeah. Most spiritual paths kind of dangle the carrot of, here, we'll get you some control.
Yes, I don't disagree. Sure, a lot of so-called spiritual practices and paths look like some kind of amelioration for confusion and suffering, which someone could characterize as improved control. Even if that meant a more elastic emotional response to the vicissitudes of living, even that could be seen or felt or pursued as improved control.
Yep. Who doesn't want to buy a, you know, a more peaceful existence or a better way to handle things?
That's right. That's right. And all of those motivating factors, which we know so well, all occur within the imagined volume of relevancy.
Yep.
of yep. mind, of body, of self, of trying to, you know, heal or mitigate vulnerability. Get a better parking spot. Find a soulmate.
They're all horse shit.
Yeah, they occur. You know, people do find soulmates. We don't know for how long or how happy, but it happens. And people do find parking spots, and some people get out of terrible jams, and some people end up as a skeleton in a heap of skeletons. Yeah. Not too successful in that case.
How can this message be so fucking irresistible? It basically takes everything away.
It can. Yes. Yes, it can. Yeah.
And well, yet it's irresistible.
It's irresistible when whatever your consciousness or one's consciousness is, becomes, you know, affectionate or stimulated by the revelation of its own irrelevancy, the revelation of its own unconditioned nature. In other words, one, it becomes somehow curiously ready or interested in dropping the mask of the body, dropping the mask of the self, dropping the mask of all the things I have to do to ensure that my life unfolds, you know, safely. We're ready, some magical thingamabob becomes curious and fond of the feeling that accompanies an investigation into unconditioned mind. It thirsts for itself. And recognizes the freedom that's inherent when present experience is not mishandled by meaning, by presumption, by control, by preference. So we notice the inherent ecstasy, the inherent euphoria, the inherent transcendence. In the recognition that experiencing does not measure nor contain you. That's weird shit. You start to get, one starts to get a glimpse into, what can we say? The source, origin, genesis, free nature of the absolute itself, right? The bright itself. We're like, whoa, wow. I had no idea I was the bright. But now that I got a few grains, a few grams of recognition that I might be the bright, I'm going that way. It makes perfect sense. That experiencing occurs, that it persists, that it seems to convey subject and object, does not confuse you. You're not looking to idealize experience. you don't mind that experience seems to have a persistent nature or manner. Because you're neither the constituent of experience, the receiver of experience, or the consequence of experience. Completely relieved of one's subjective nature. Experience can and will do what it pleases. And I'm done with the seduction for possession or control. Take that, Adyashanti.